Now check into your history. The Murrays. Get in close, you get the colors. Monroes. All these reds are hard to translate through the camera. The Menzies. The Mathesons. McRae. You better not be caught wearing a color that you're not entitled to. McQuarrie. McPherson. McFees. McFarlands. McNeil. You could tell the Klan as far as you saw him coming. McNichol. Now, people have always, you know, there have been bright colors with every culture. But no single race of people have made a many-colored coat so important as these Scots, who mean, the name means wanderer. Is an absolute cognate transliteration of Scooth, Nomad, Scythians, McNab, Macmillan, MacLeod, MacLennan, MacLean. You getting tired of the Macs? It means son of Lean, son of Millen. McLaurin, son of Lauren. McLaughlin. McKinnon. They all look alike after a while. Well, they know the difference. McKenzie. McKay. McIver. McIntosh. McIntyre, McKinney's, McGregor, McGilvery, McDougal, McDuff, and on it goes. Fascinating reading on the history of the clans and the importance of their shield and the armor bearings and all the other, the badge and all the elements of their crest, each family. I just bring it up at this point. Why these people that are Scoots, Scots, Scooths, Scythians, Wanderers, why do they end up with the many-colored coat? Let's throw that in. His bow, verse 24, abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong with the hands of the mighty God of Israel. From thence, look at this parenthesis thrown in there. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. What in the world does it mean? From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. That means that from Joseph, included in the blessing, from them will come, or with them is, the shepherd, and he'll go with them, the stone of Israel. Now, in the New Testament, every evangelical preacher has heard many times the preaching on the text by Paul, that they all drank from the same spiritual rock. Remember that phrase? They all drank. Speaking of Israel wandering through the wilderness, they all drank from the same spiritual rock. And he says that rock was Christ. Now, because we know where it's at, well, we know enough about it in its details, and know its use down through the history of the Israelites, we don't really think it's too mystical or odd for the tabernacle to represent Christ, for the veil to be Christ, rent from top to bottom at the crucifixion. We don't think it too mystical or strange. The Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat, Christ. We have an absolute relic that became so much of a relic that it was worshipped in place of God until Hezekiah had to bring it forth, call it Nehushtan, which means a thing of brass, and smash it. But when Moses put the brazen serpent on the pole and raised it to the healing of the shepherds, I mean the Israelites, they carried it with them. They kept it as a relic. And that was Christ our sin bearer. But because it disappeared from history, we spiritualize that rock was Christ. It was the pattern of the Old Testament to use material things to represent in type and shadow the substance that's going to come. Why is it far out to believe that they drank from an actual rock that was just as the Ark of the Covenant was the type of Christ, that Ark was the type of Christ? They all drank from the same spiritual rocks, what he says. Well, usually you mean that rock that Moses, when they went to Rephidim in the book of Exodus, and it was a dry spot and they murmured, God said, strike the rock and water poured out. But when you read that passage, it's equally enigmatic, because God says to Moses, go to the rock. You would expect in a place where rocks are everywhere, someone to say, which rock? And have the people go stand by the rock. Definite article used. Which rock? Not just any old rock. There were 3 million people. All the criers get their voice. Everybody go to the rock. You got people going every direction. There's nothing but rocks around there. How'd they know which rock to go to? Now, I've taught on this before, even gave the book away. It doesn't make sense at all that Jacob would have left that rock that he anointed and called the house of God. It doesn't make sense that he wouldn't have carried it to Egypt. That explains the enigmatic statement here, from thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. That rock that he had anointed and called it the house of God is going to go with them. I don't know what the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night was. People don't have any trouble believing that. How do you know it wasn't the rock? Made to burn at night, condescend into smoke in the day? Doesn't have to be, but it could have been. But Joseph is assigned this rock, which is called the shepherd. The shepherd leads. Now they come to Rephidim, and they're thirsty, and God says, strike the rock. And it is stricken, and water pours forth. You don't hear about water need anymore until in the book of Numbers, once more they're at a place and they're very thirsty, and God says, this time sanctify me and speak to the rock. And God was so concerned that he not break the type, that the rock must be stricken only once as the type of Christ, he denied the promised land to Moses because he got mad at the people and said, you rebels, and struck the rock a second time. Now, there is absolutely no logic In fact, logic demands. If it wasn't the same rock, he wasn't striking the same rock twice. The reason he was punished so much is the seriousness of his deed was to strike the same rock, because that rock was a type of Christ, and thereby suggest that Christ had to be smitten twice. If it had been another rock, no problem. The matter would have been simple disobedience, but not interference with the revelation type of the rock. There's much more logic to suggest it's the same rock. And furthermore, if they weren't carrying the rock on which Jacob laid his head, would you have left that rock that water poured out of in the wilderness? You would have taken it with you, particularly if you're in the desert. I mean, it doesn't matter what, I'd be putting my lips to that flinty rock and sucking on it every day in that hot desert. There ain't no way you could get me away from that rock. Now, there's a very interesting passage where they come to a group of people and Moses makes a deal with them. He says, let us go through your land. We promise we will not take any of your water, the most valuable asset of the desert. Now he says, if our animals drink any of your water, we'll pay you for it. Now dumb animals wouldn't know the difference. How did 3 million people on a hot desert journey for days through this desert area and partake of no water from the territory? They were carrying their water supply. The rock. From the time it was smitten, it became their water supply. Not a single person in evangelical Christianity has any trouble believing the statement that their shoes didn't wear out. That's a miracle. Their shoes didn't wear out for 4 years. No trouble believing that manna came down every day except on the Sabbath, and if you kept it over one day, it turned rotten and full of worms, except on Friday, you could gather twice as much, and it would keep over on Saturday. Manna from heaven every day. Well, it's absolutely no harder to have a rock that's your water supply, incongruous though it may seem, after the first smiting, than to believe manna falls from heaven, shoes don't wear out, and a pillar of fire by night and cloud by day leads you along. Now, if it was the water supply, there was a bush that burned and didn't burn up. Fire around that at night would lead. And condensation during the day would be a nice pillar of smoke. Didn't have to be that. I'm just trying to open our eyes to the fact that it's no harder for God to make the water supply be this flinty rock after Moses struck it the first time in order to perfect the type of Christ. That rock, they all drank from that same spiritual rock, and that rock was Christ. The stone, the shepherd of Israel, that stone is to lead them, and it perfects the type to have it, once the water starts to flow, the constant supply of water as they need it. Now, I'm saying to you, if that's true, it would explain why in modern England, that rock under the coronation chair is called Jacob's pillar. And if you look close at it, it has a big crack in it. And one has to wonder, did that crack occur when it was smitten? It is of a stone not common to the British Isles, but rather from Palestine. And it's called by modern England Jacob's pillar. And it has iron rings, deeply worn. Now, if Jacob carried it to Egypt, and if the promise to Joseph made Joseph the custodian, and if it was carried through the wilderness for 40 years and became their water supply, their shepherd. That rock was Christ, is exactly what Paul says. Then it explains why the iron rings are so worn. Now, you don't lose this pillar in the books of Judges, Joshua and Judges. In Joshua 19, the lots of the tribes are laid out. As it describes the boundaries, it makes reference again and again, just like when God told Moses to go stand by the rock, as though you know which rock. The normal question is, which rock, unless it's a rock everybody knows? The only possible one God would be referring to. The same is true when the boundaries and allotments are given. They describe the boundaries from the pillar stone, the rock at the corner of Ephraim and the adjoining territory. The marker stone, the benchmark from which the lots are laid out for the tribes, includes a known stone on the corner of Ephraim's territory, right where it ought to be. As they move through Joshua and Judges into the kings, you will read again and again, every time a king is crowned, he stands beside or on a standing pillar, and it's always referred to with a commonality of meaning. The pillar. He stood by the pillar and was crowned. They bring the boy king out that had been hidden when they tried to stamp out Judah's line, and they crowned him beside the pillar as the custom was. It was the coronation stone, the shepherd stone. And when Jeremiah leaves Palestine, within 5 years, the old man shows up, as I said last night, in Ireland, having stopped off in Spain, with the daughter of a king, one of Zedekiah's daughters, a servant named Simon Brook, a cognate transliteration of Baruch, and he joins the hand of the High King of Ireland, the Milesian King of the Zara line that's ruling over the Tuatha De Danann, having conquered them, having been a ruler over the Milesians, and the descendant of David through Zedekiah as a daughter, the tender twig transplanted, is joined in marriage, and at Tara, and you don't have to do much with Tara to come to Torah, law. At Tara, the headquarters is established, and he brings with himself the stone of destiny, Leophael. And that stone is the stone on which the High King of Ireland is then crowned as Judah and Zara lines are joined together to rule in Ireland. That stone became the symbol of authority of the king. It is carried when Fergus conquers Ireland to Scotland and becomes the basis of authority for the Scottish kings. When they conquered Scotland, the English kings knew there would be no authority accepted over the Scots without that stone. And they took that stone to Westminster Abbey, where it lies under the coronation chair. When Second World War was in progress, Hitler, as the Raiders of the Lost Ark accurately portrays, was a fanatic seeking religious relics. They hid that stone, secreted the hiding place in papers sent to Canada, in order that should London fall, no chance that stone would fall into Hitler's hands, and the English people prized that stone above anything else that could happen. And today they call it Jacob's Pillar. One more connection. I'm going to go back to demonology. I'm not going to let the devil win this one tonight. I'm reading from The Demonologist, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren. by Gerald Brittle, the book we've been trying to get for you. But this flamethrower again tonight. And finally, there is the black lace veil. 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 I don't want to intimidate you till you can't. Sort of anticipate with me. Just remember it's a serious subject. And finally, there is the black lace veil. The veil figured in a case of possession where an inhuman spirit delivered a pointed message to Ed Warren. The possessing entity's voice was clearly recorded on tape. The Warrens, sitting together in an overstuffed or on an overstuffed sofa in the occult museum, now explain the strange case of the young woman who had one day been brought into Ed's office with other spirit-related problems. Turn the lights down. Ed and I had been lecturing to a college audience. Lorraine begins. It was an otherwise normal lecture, except that I could sense there was a negative presence in the auditorium. Well, I've done that. And for the life of me, I couldn't pick it out. When we speak to groups of people, I can usually tell who's there. Clergymen, for instance, often come wearing turtlenecks or sports shirts. But I can see their clergy by the light beige aura that surrounds the ordained. I didn't know that. Perfectly okay to laugh at me, as long as you don't laugh about the demons. Satanists and black witchcraft groups often show up at our lectures. Dressed like everyone else. But their auras stand out too. Now you remember Lorraine was a parapsychologist, psychic. Ed wasn't. He's just a demonologist. On this occasion, however, I just couldn't locate the source of the negative vibrations. When the question session was over, people from the audience came forward as usual. A dozen people surrounded Ed and a dozen people surrounded me. After about 15 minutes, I looked over and saw that Ed was speaking with a young male student. Next to the boy stood a girl who, for some reason, was seething with rage. I promptly excused myself from the group around me and went over to be with Ed. Alan, the boy who had been talking to me, says Ed, brought his girlfriend, Lonnie, to our lecture because he suspected that she had been overtaken by some occult influence. He told me that when his girlfriend became angry, she would fill up with intense hate and rage, her features would change into something resembling a wolf, and then the voice of a different person would speak from inside her. Now, if you think that's strange, read the New Testament, the first few chapters of Mark, until he comes upon the demoniac of the Gadarenes. When Lorraine came over to me, the girl experienced an episode of instantaneous possession right there on the stage. She lurched out and actually tried to kill Lorraine. The incident not only scared Lorraine, it also scared the wits out of everyone else around us, who quickly moved away. We ended the audience chat session right there. I took Lonnie and her boyfriend to an offstage room. In the meantime, Lonnie waited out in the hall while I spoke with these two. In the backstage room, the girl was fully under possession. She was breathing heavily while the entity possessing her was completely overtaken with an intense, violent hatred. Her facial features were also somewhat transformed into the wolf-like appearance the boy had talked about. The off-pitch voice projected by the entity later proved to be dissimilar to that of the girl. I didn't have a tape recorder with me at the time, but it hardly mattered because the thing possessing the girl was simply caught up in a snarling, accusatory rage. After about 10 minutes, the possession passed. Then the girl seemed to be all right, at least if I didn't crowd her, which seemed to reinstigate possession. So to avoid trouble, I sat on the opposite side of the room. Ed's telling this story. When I felt she could be spoken to, I told her about the incident I just witnessed. She told me she had some slight awareness of her condition, though what she complained about was a loss of memory that made her think she was losing her mind. She couldn't account for hours and even whole days in her life. Over the course of the previous 3 months, she explained, this had been getting worse. I told her that loss of memory went hand in hand with possession, because there was nothing for her to remember. The gaps in time represented episodes of possession where life was being experienced not by her but by the possessing entity. Yet before anything could be done for the girl, the real question that had to be answered was, why had she been experiencing possession at all? Lonnie, I found out, was a well-to-do, perhaps even spoiled, young lady. Now this is the book that we've been trying to get for you. I don't want you to forget it in the long time that we're taking getting it printed. We are going to get it printed so you can finish some of the stories I haven't had time to finish. And you'll get it. At King's House 1, it'll be given to everyone who attends there. Lonnie, I found out, was well-to-do, perhaps even spoiled, on the Sunday that we give it away. Just want that clear. Whichever Sunday Craig finally manages to get it, that's the Sunday we give it away. No other day. Lonnie, I found out, was well-to-do, perhaps even spoiled young lady, who was wealthy enough to buy anything she wanted. About a year earlier, however, there came a point in her life when she encountered something money couldn't buy. That something was the young man sitting next to her. Alan, enrolled at an Ivy League school in a nearby state. Lonnie had met him in her hometown the summer before, and apparently they'd went out on a few dates. By the end of the summer, though, the boy had no feeling for Lonnie and ignored her approaches. She, on the other hand, had seized on this guy passionately. He couldn't rest until she made him her own. In essence, she saw Alan as a desirable commodity, not as a human being. This dehumanization of a person got noticed. I say this because the girl tried every possible method to gain the boy's affection, from writing him enticing letters to sending him money for travel tickets so he could visit her at school. But none of the tactics worked, at least not until she hit upon ritual witchcraft, which is where the black lace veil comes in. To get Alan in her clutches, she turned to the occult. Lonnie went out to a store and found herself a book on the black arts, the title of which I won't mention. Lonnie took the book home later that week, privately performed a ritual for acquiring lovers. An old ritual that has gotten people in trouble for ages. The Warrens are often reluctant to give precise details, such as the names of conjuring books, the specific ritual of witchcraft an individual used, or the names of spirits responsible for particular demonic attacks. Why? I don't mention the names of spirits, says Ed, because knowing a particular demonic name is to give recognition to that entity. If you give it recognition, no matter how small, you're going to give it fuel to manifest.
This is the end of Side 3. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 4. Thank you.